please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Nick from the Telford Group.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Nick. I'm an alcoholic. So I'm grateful to be here. I'm grateful to clean this over. And it's a privilege and an honor to be here. And, you know, I do have a justified resentment against Mike for asking me to be the backup speaker, but it's okay. Any chance I can get to talk is, you know, I love hearing myself talk. So I try to convey a message of hope and recovery and, you know, what this program has provided for me, you know, the past couple of years. So I'll start at the beginning. You know, I was born in 1975. No, I'm not going to go back that far, but you know, as a child, I was thinking, you know, my first addiction was a pacifier. I remember screaming and crying, like thinking back, like I had to have this thing. And, you know, that's how my childhood went. From there, it went to toys. It went to, having to have my way, being spoiled, throwing temper tantrums. And, you know, that was my childhood. Always wanting more. It was never enough. My dad would always say to me, tomorrow's another day. You can't have your way. And I just hated that. And that's how my, you know, my childhood went. I remember being dropped off at like kindergarten and first grade and just being full of fear and terror. And, you know, watching my mom walk away and just burst into tears for like no reason, just of this, delusion that, you know, I was scared and I was afraid. And that's how it was. And, you know, I would do anything I could to stay home from school. I was an excellent manipulator. I figured out what buttons to push, what words to say to, you know, to manipulate my parents. And, you know, I could strong arm my mom. I strong armed my mom for a long time. My dad was always the enforcer. You know, he was the bad guy. He was in the military and he was, you know, very straight laced and, worked hard. He was just an overall great guy. And he always just wanted me to be a strong young man, like just teaching me principles and, you know, to be responsible. And, my mom would just like, you know, kind of push him out of the way. And so I know who to go to if I wanted to get my way with my mom, because she could always, you know, take my side. And my dad, you know, he still, you know, has resentments against my grandparents, against her for not, enforcing me to, you know, be a little more strict and make me do my chores and do stuff, you know, my whole life. And I think that, that carried on into my adult years. So going back, you know, I went to Catholic school, great education. There was no trauma in my life that caused me, I think, to be an alcoholic or to start drinking. Other than watching, people in my family, drink and enjoy it. And, I could not wait to do it. I didn't know what it did, but I know it did something because everybody was doing it and they were having a good time. And, you know, I remember could not wait to do it. And, when that chance came, I jumped on it. You know, my dad would send me to the refrigerator and have him grab a beer for him. And, you know, I'd pop the top and drink some bubbles. And then like, all right, I see. And I hated the taste at first. I just didn't see, what it was until, you know, I remember my first wedding when I drank a bunch of peach schnapps and I'm like, hey, all right. I'm like, my legs started moving. I'm like, oh, I hit the dance floor and I'm cutting it up. And I'm like, okay, now I see why people drink. And it was fun, you know, and it was fun for a very, very long time. I think, it was like seventh or eighth grade, you know, like our first, party, we like stole a bunch of booze. Like, I think there were Michelob ponies or something. You know, in a gym bag from my friend's garage. And, you know, my mom let us have a party in the backyard. And, you know, I took advantage of her because she was a pushover. And, you know, I could always pull the wool over her eyes. And, you know, we got caught. And, you know, just the simple slaps on the wrist, you know. And as things progressed, the consequences started becoming more severe with, like, the underage drinking, tickets, and you know, being down at, like, a Dead show or, like, Pink Floyd concert and undercover cops walking up and saying, boom, do you have ID? And bang, you know, another charge. And of course, who do I call? Is mom and dad. And they, you know, they get me out of it again. And there was no accountability in my whole life. There was no, responsibility. It was just, you know, doing whatever I wanted, whenever I wanted it. And, you know, so around sixth grade, my teacher, I started slacking a little bit in my schooling, and my teacher said he needs to start learning to make his own decisions a little bit. And my mom, you know, listened to this teacher, this guy, Mr. Alosi. I remember him, and funny thing, like he would like smack guys on the head with his graduation ring, and I couldn't wait till my turn to do that because I wanted to be in with the cool guys who were getting, you know, have to stay after school and clean the erasers and sweep the floors because all the cool guys were being chosen. He kind of had his little crew, and I wanted to be liked. I wanted to be in there like that, and that's kind of what I did. I was wanting to be in the in crowd, and I had to do whatever it was to be in there. So my mom listened to this guy and gave me a little more leeway, and then that's when my education and my schooling started going downhill. I was a pretty straight, you know, like A student until that point. And then from like 6th, 7th, and 8th grade, it was a slow decline. I got into St. Joe's Prep my freshman year in high school, and I just hated it. It was an all-guys school down in North Philadelphia, and I had to take 3 buses to get there, and didn't see that my parents just wanted me to have a better education than what some of the kids in my neighborhood were going to, just the archdiocese schools and public schools, and, you know, and I thought I was being punished by having to go to this school. So I went there my freshman year of high school, and I just, like I said, I hated it. I remember I had Latin as one of my classes, and I couldn't stand that. And, you know, having more opportunity and stuff like that to further my education, to like think of the future of college. And I wanted no part of it. You know, I just wanted to have fun, and, you know, and I basically flunked myself out of that school and transferred to, a Catholic school in Northeast Philadelphia, because that's where all my friends were going. And that's what really where the partying started happening. I already had a little taste of alcohol, and it was a huge school, so I was trying to fit in. I was trying to find, you know, I came in my sophomore year, so I was a little bit behind with like making friends and meeting people, and I gravitated towards some guys who talked about beer, and I had a little experience with drinking, and they're like, we're getting a case of beer, you want to split a case of beer Friday night, and it came down to, yeah, let's do that, you know. And that's just kind of how it all started. And from that point on, that's all my primary purpose throughout high school was just drinking and getting drunk. You know, I watch kids, you know, later in high school, like going away to universities and talking about, you know, the SATs and stuff like that. And I didn't care about any of that. And, you know, somehow I did pass, I did graduate high school. But, like I said, kids were going to universities and thinking about furthering their career. And all I cared about was, you know, where's the booze at this weekend, and whose parents are going away, and you know, where's the party at, and that's all I really, you know, was concerned with. Until I graduated from high school, and I got, you know, I'm left to a decision. What do I do now? And I'm like, well, I'll just find a job. And I'm like, nobody wants to hire me. And like thinking back, I have no experience with anything. You know, I'm like, well, why can't I be? I want to be work in the restaurant, be a waiter. Well, you got to start in the kitchen, kid. You can't just like jump up to the most, you know, lucrative part of the restaurant. You got to start in the kitchen, work your way up. Like my dad was trying to explain to me growing up, you got to work for things. You got to earn your, way through life. And I was an excellent, excellent quitter. It's one of my, you know, great, strong points was I'll start something and be pretty gung ho in the beginning and then just quit. And they're just, you know, and that's kind of how my whole life I was like that. I'm a terrible procrastinator. I start strong and then I just fizzle out with sports, with education, with girlfriends, with you name it. As I got older, the same way, like I'd find a way into an apartment and get on the lease and be good in the beginning. And then other stuff became more important, and bills and stuff and everything became secondary. It's just how my life was. So I went to school for a little bit at Bucks County Community College, and I just hated it. I would just go there and just go sleep in the break room, whatever. And I think I went to a couple classes, and then, you know, I'm already signed myself out because I just, you know, I was only concerned with what we're doing later on that night, you know, not about, you know, maybe, you know, furthering my education. And that's how that went. And I had an awesome opportunity. My grandfather had a friend whose daughter lived in Colorado, and she was doing pretty well. It was a small ski town. Where they had employee housing, and like they paid pretty well because it was a little more expensive to live out there. And, you know, again, my grandfather opened these doors for me, and, you know, they gave me a little bit of money to move out there, and things were going well for a little bit. I got the job, you know, I was a ski instructor, snowboard instructor, and got the employee housing, and everything was like going on the up and up. But I'm an alcoholic, and, you know, my biggest concern is, you know, like I said, I start strong with stuff, and then I fizzle out. And once I find out that this is a party town, like they're saying was like ski hard, party harder, and you know, all we did was basically work to fund our party. You know, I know like the bills, everything, paying rent. You know, I got thrown out of the employee housing because I couldn't work enough to have them take the money out of my paycheck to pay my rent. So, you know, I hit the bricks, kid. And so, you know, I find a group of guys who are all kind of the same age, and I made some really good friends out there. And you know, so we get a place together, like five or six of us, and they're all working hard and paying their rent, you know, and I'm groveling on the phone like, oh, I can't make ends meet, and asking, begging for money, you know, calling home and asking. And, you know, I work a little bit, just enough to, like, you know, pay back the money I probably borrowed throughout the week or 2 weeks when, you know, after between pay periods, and have to do what I have to do in order to pay rent and eventually get thrown out. And then, you know, it's just that vicious cycle. And again, like the partying was just getting more and more important. It was more of a necessity than just a pleasure or a hobby. I talk about the ease and comfort that alcohol would bring. And I noticed myself, my sleep pattern started changing, and there's like anxiety starting to unfold throughout the night, waking up and be like, well, you know, what's this feeling? And I got to have, you know, something next to me at all times, some kind of substance to get that ease and comfort. And, you know, in the progression slowly started, you know, my tolerance is going through the roof, and I'm trying other, you know, other avenues of ease. You know, and the whole time I'm thinking, if I could just get ahead a little bit, you know, what can I do to get ahead a little bit? If someone would just lend me some money, or, you know, if I could just get a better job, although I wasn't really looking for a job, you know, and, you know, I sought other ways to make money in the black market. And, you know, I wasn't very good at that either. You know, I'd get somebody to like help me out with something, and then I couldn't make ends meet on that end either. And everything I tried to do was pretty much a failure throughout that time. I mean, relationships, you know, family life. You know, I'm so far away, and they would answer my phone calls when I called, but it all came down to me just saying at the end of the thing, like, well, if you could, you know, send me a little bit of money, it's real tough out here, and just saying what exactly, making them feel sorry for me, giving the sob story, and hoping that they'll, like, you know, throw me a bone. And for a long time they did, you know, and things just got out of hand, and I said, you know what, I'm going to go back to PA and go back there. And, you know, and back and forth I bounced. You know, I went back home for a year and worked and made, you know, showed I was doing okay, and then borrowed some more money and got someone to buy me a truck. Like, my grandparents bought me a vehicle, and because they were just always trying to be helpful. And, you know, again, like, I'm just a spoiled kid. You know, I'm 21 years old, and I'm still just spoiled and, like, self-centered, like, to the core. And so much help and so much love my family has given me, and I'll just take advantage of it. That's what I do. So I go back out west, and I bounce back and forth throughout the years, going back and forth. For 17 years, I did that. In 2008, I came home, because again, geographical solution will fix everything. And started working. You know, this time I had a lot of experience in the restaurant, and I got a job as a bar manager in South Philadelphia. Perfect. They gave me the keys to the liquor room. I opened and closed the restaurant. You know, now I'm in real control of this thing. So I thought, and just the accessibility, it just went through, just skyrocketed. Like, the little things would start happening. Like, I'd get a car, like a nicer car, and like, I'd build myself up, and I'm super excellent at like building up and tearing down, you know, and that's just kind of how my whole life was. Like, I start strong, and then I lose interest, or I just want to drink and party mostly. You know, so I find myself getting fired, you know, I'm in the hole again. And my parents and they call me over for lunch one day, and there's some stranger sitting in my sister's living room, and I'm like, oh, I've seen this before on TV. And here we go. It's my first intervention. And I'm like, who are you, man? You're come to my house. I'm like, this is my sister's house. And I'm just like half in the bag, you know, like, yeah, this is ridiculous. I can't believe you guys would do this to me. And you know, all this, you know, just being so arrogant. And I said, I'm totally fine. I can lick this thing anytime I want. I just don't want to. And out I go for like, I know I ran for a couple of days, and then they're like, well, the ultimatums were there. You can't come here. We don't want you around the kids. We don't want you around the family. We're not lending any more money. The car my dad co-signed, we're taking that because, you know, his credit's in jeopardy and you're not paying the bills like you promised. And I'm like, all right, I'll tell you, I'll do it by myself and I'll take the bus. And, you know, so I got these great ideas. I'm just going to take public transportation everywhere. And I think I lasted like 2 days at some girl I was dating. I took hostage. I was at her place. You know, I had nowhere to go. My friends didn't want me around anymore. And she was kind enough to, you know, let me stay there. And finally, I just said, all right, I exhausted all my avenues and all my, ideas basically and said, oh, all right, well, I guess I'll try rehab. I haven't tried that yet. And so I went to Living Grin and, I'm going through withdrawal from multiple things. And for some reason, they decided I didn't need detox. So right away, you're not taking care of me here. I'm going through all this stuff and I'm shaking. And my dad's like, well, you did this to yourself. You know, he was very forward like that. He said, he'd come to visit me and a week later, I'm still shaking and like, you know, just going through it. And he's like, well, you got to go through some pain, kid. You did this to yourself. You know, and I was like, well, I feel like. So I sat it out. You know, I made it through that first stint at rehab. And in there, I'm saying one and done. And I see the 12 steps on the wall. And it's Greek to me. And I had no idea what this is all about. You know, I'm just thinking if I could just, learn how to control this thing a little bit better. And, you know, in my head, I'm like, I'm going to get out of here and I can still do what I want to do. I just won't get out of control this time, you know. I just won't do that one thing or that other thing. And they told me to do certain things when I was in there, you know, get out, get a home group, make 90 meetings in 90 days, get a sponsor, start working the steps with your sponsor. And, you know, all that stuff did not seem interesting to me at all. So I didn't do any of it. You know, I think I drank like a couple days out of there but it was like nothing happened. You know, I'd have a beer or two and I'm like, well, I'm okay. Nothing happened. I'm not, you know, I'm not like homeless again, but I was homeless because I was living on my parents' couch, you know. So of course I put all my finance, you know, everything was financial. Nothing, it wasn't about, they said, put your recovery first. I'm like, well, I got to work. I got bills. Like, how am I supposed to, in my head, I'm thinking, just go to meetings and not work. It's like, didn't even see the true meaning behind putting your recovery first. I'm like, yeah, you got to take, you know, do some things and get your finances in order. But make recovery the most important thing in your life, is what I've been taught and what I've learned throughout the years. So 6, 7, you know, 8 rehabs later, it was on repeat. I tried detoxes, I tried rehabs, I tried psychiatric, you know, medication. I went that route, you know, because I know I could probably get something if I said the right things to these doctors the same thing over and over. I finally went to Penn Foundation almost 4 years ago, and my parents said, look, you got to try something different. You cannot come back here. My sister didn't want me there. My grandparents don't want me around. Try a halfway house, try a recovery house. So I didn't qualify for a halfway house because I did have some income, So I started shopping recovery houses, and my counselor, caseworker, whatever, at the rehab, you know, found one in Quakertown. I'm like, Quakertown? I don't know. I've heard of it before. I've been driving by there, going still into the Poconos to go skiing. But I don't know anybody that lives out there. I don't know. What am I going to do there? And the willingness still wasn't there. You know, I still had some ideas. So I got out of there, and my parents helped me out with the first week or two of the recovery house. Great place called the Hope House in Quakertown. And I remember signing the lease with the owner, and she's like, we want you here a minimum of 90 days. So boom, break my head, 90 days, I'm out of here. I already got, you know, great ideas. And, you know, I got a little taste of recovery that time. You know, and I remember like digging through some of my boxes, and I found a pill bottle, and I didn't even hesitate to take whatever it was I found. So I knew like there was something going on. And I figured out how to, you know, I'm a really good manipulator and like how to, you know, master the system. And, you know, I knew if they like drug test me a certain day, they wouldn't pop me if I did this a certain day. And not even seeing the warning signs that I was already breaking away from what was saving my life at the time. And, the 90 days was up, and my sister's like, you're doing so well. You're welcome to come stay here with us. And my niece and nephew and the dog I love dearly. you know, as soon as I got there, they're like, well, can you go to, I was like, I'm going to a meeting, and the kids were like, oh, you just got here, can you just cook us dinner? And I'm like, that was the first night, and right there, it was like, it just started from there, and then slowly the excuses started piling up why, you know, I can't go to a meeting tonight, I've got work, I'm working night shift tomorrow, and like, there come the excuses, and all the stuff that was like a little bit of taste of sobriety that I was doing in the recovery house slowly started dwindling. You know, I was praying a little bit, not much meditation at all. You know, I was making a lot of meetings, and I was surrounded by recovery, but still in my heart, I think there was some reservation there. And then, you know, I learned it's got to be smashed. You cannot have any type of reservation at all, or you won't drink or drug again. And that's just my experience. And so basically, I went out for another 4 months, really hard. I mean, it was real bad. They say you pick up right where you left off, and I surely did. I remember driving. You know, I'd stop at the bar and do a, you know, a shot and a beer, and then like head down to, you know, get something else I really like to do. And I'm going down there, I'm shaking my head to myself, this is gonna be bad, you know. And I would talk myself out of it. And, you know, that's the disease, like saying you'll be all right, won't get that bad. And boy, did it, and quick. You know, so here we go again. You know, my sister's like, something's changing you. You're not the same. You're not interactive with us anymore. You don't even look us in the eyes. You're sneaking around. You're not here. You're not present. You know, what's wrong? And they're surrounding me. I'm sleeping in. I'm not a person who sleeps in. I like to get up and get going. And for now, I'm sleeping in. And my dad and my sister come in and they, you know, confront me. And I'm like, oh, I'm just really tired. And there it was. And I'm pretty much in the grip of it again. And it was rough. But in my heart, you know, the seed was planted again. There was the taste of recovery, there was a taste of sobriety. And, you know, eventually, you know, the previous times people held my hand to get into rehab and to detox. And for once, I picked the phone up. I made the phone calls. I started speaking differently to my dad. I said, look, if I'm going to do this, I need to do this myself for once. You guys have held my hand this every time. I'm going to make the phone calls. I won't go to rehab today, but I'll go tomorrow because I got to do something today. Let's get this straight. But tomorrow I'll definitely make the calls and do that. But and I did. And I, you know, I got Penn gladly took me back again for the fifth time. And you know, there was the pain was a lot greater for me this time. And something changed that time in there. I started talking to counselors more. A really awesome person that works there, MJ. I pull her aside and talk to her, and I started, like, I was there with like a purpose. I think I was really just all around done. I mean, done spiritually bankrupt, emotionally, mentally, just shot. I mean, just I was gonna die. Like I mean, it was either that or death. So I chose that and asked for help and dug in when I was there. You know, didn't get involved with any of the rehab romances that were going on, saw going on, and try to steer clear of the drama and you know, and just from experience, like just having this mindset, like I'm here, it's a short time here, I'm really just going to take advantage of this thing. It's free. I'm here, you know, my insurance is not going to last forever, so I need to do something. It was all about action that time, and something, you know, something clicked when I was there. I broke down a few times and actually shed tears and just asked God to please help me. And you know, I shared with others about the pain I was going through and how I was just really sick of doing this over and over again. And for once, like, you know, I'm willing to try anything you got. Like, I'm that desperate to really do whatever it is you lay in front of me. So the time went quick, and I was nervous to get out, but I the foundation was a little bit started, and again, I made some calls, and I knew that this recovery house was a safe place, and it was worked a little bit for me before, and Betty's an awesome person, the owner, and I talked to her, and she said, of course, you're welcome back here. We, you know, we were sad you left so soon before, and so I got back into the recovery house. That was May of 2016, so April 16, 2016 is my sobriety date. I went in there, and anything they asked of me, I said yes for once. You know, I wasn't fighting about the chores. I wasn't fighting about what room I was going to be in, who my roommate was, you know, if there was stuff going on, there was so much drama going on between these two houses. And my buddy's like, how do you just fly under the radar? I'm like, well, I don't know, man. I'm not going to go there, really. I'm here for a different reason. I don't care about the drama. I don't care about all the BS. Like, I'm trying to save my life here. And if you want help, I'll help you. But if you're going to do other stuff, I'm steering clear of it. And they tell you to stick with the winners and guys who are there trying to do the same thing. And there was a great group of guys there, and we all were on this path together, and we stuck together. And it was sad to watch guys come and go. I could see the pain in their eyes when they were packing their bags and leaving and not having anywhere to go and having to take a 72-hour hiatus when they came up hot on the test or got caught doing something they shouldn't be doing. I just said, man, come back, please. Do what you got to do. Get it out of you and go get help and please come back. I ended up staying there almost 17 months. There were many opportunities to move out, and I did not. I just said, you know what, I'm not taking my will back in any way until it feels right in my heart. And I talk it over with some people, and things seem different and seem okay. Then I'll jump on it. Like before, I was like, someone dangled a carrot in front of me, and I jumped right on it because I just wasn't there yet. And my, what a difference that made staying there that long. They asked me to be a house manager at some point, and I declined, and then I said, you know what, if I can help out, I'll do it for a little while until someone else wants to step up. And there was like, the willingness. I just said yes to anything and everything they asked of me. If somebody asked me to sponsor them, I would talk to my sponsor and just say yes. I didn't think I could help anybody in any way. I'm like, you don't want anything I got. But if somebody builds up the courage to ask you to sponsor them, which is very difficult for some people to do, have in your heart to say yes. Or if not, put them in someone else's hands. To say no to somebody outright, you can really hurt them in AA or any fellowship, I truly believe. So I took a job I really didn't want to take. I had to start at the beginning, square one. I had no license. I was going through a DUI. And I just did what my mom always said. You take a job till you find something better, until something better comes along. And doors started opening up. Most importantly, I surrounded myself around recovery. I did what they asked me. I got a home group. I do have three home groups now because I do everything alcoholically. So, I just try to stay involved to the best of my ability. I put a lot of effort into my drinking career and drugging career. So if I could put some of that effort towards my recovery, it's how it has to be for an alcoholic like me. I got to be all the way in, or I'm already on the way out. And there were some hard times at the recovery house, but I managed, with stepping up my prayer game and meditation and learning these tools that can help me set me free of the bondage of self and the stuff that's blocking me from God. Things started getting a little bit easier, not necessarily in life, just with myself. I was sleeping better. I was more calm. These things that they told me would work were starting to work. I just didn't see how it could be possible, and it was starting to work, and it was truly a miracle. A guy like me could get free of this thing. I mean, from where I was and where I came from, to what it's like now, it's truly is a miracle. And we're all, my cousin would say, like, I don't know, I want your life. I don't know how you're still alive, but this is, we all are walking miracles being here tonight. Like I said, service is a huge part of it. That triangle is crucial. I try working bits and pieces of it. I try just making a lot of meetings and not doing anything else, and that's just not enough. And I really, I had to be 100% in and be wholeheartedly done. There could be no reservation. All those got to be smashed. There can be no ideas that I can someday, control and enjoy this thing or dabble a little bit or just, and it took a little while for me to get that with a lot of pain and experience and, trial and error. And, I don't know. I just stepped my game up. I just kept pushing. I got a home group. I got a good sponsor, and he walked me through the fourth and fifth step, things I would balk on before. I finally did it. I sat down with him. I took time to meet with him and talk one-on-one when I was full of fear. I believe, if you're having problems with four and five, you backtrack to one, two, and three. What's your relationship with God like? And if you're strong with God, you have a good conscious contact, you should go into four and five fearless. you know, like I said, that the taste of recovery was there. There was a little bit of experience, and they told me to get on my knees every morning in the beginning, just thank God for being sober. And today, before I even get out of bed, before I do anything, I don't say my normal prayers. I just say thank God for keeping me sober again another day. And I do my little routine, and then, you know, and then I come down, and I have my little prayer card, and I get on my knees and humble myself. And I used to be embarrassed to get on my knees in a room by myself. Like, get over it, kid. You know, and it feels good now. I have to have that every morning. I've been really trying to work on my meditation too, and everybody, it's your own form, whatever works for you. I like to put on quiet music and just find that quiet time. And it takes a lot of practice for me to, like, shut my brain down when there's so many, like, thoughts, like, well, what's going to happen at work? Well, blah, blah, blah. My mom and dad, like, stop. I just got to tell myself, just stop, or just give yourself 5-10 minutes of just quiet. And that's practice. You know, it's prayer and meditation, not prayer or meditation. And, you know, going back, like, towards the steps, I mean, one, I know I'm powerless every day. I remember that every day I wake up and I'm powerless over alcohol. Dash, my life was unmanageable. Not because of how I drank, just because I couldn't manage my emotions. I couldn't manage, you know, anything in life, let alone my drinking. You know, looking at four, I mean, what was my part in all this stuff? You know, I thought I was I was always the one, you know, getting the raw deal and the short end of the stick. And there was always some part. There was always some part that I was involved in each and every one of those things. Looking at it from a different view. For once in my life, and being open-minded to that, not being like, I am a victim here, and forget that, I'll never forget that person, and that's not, you know, there's no way. And, you know, talking about it and asking for help and being shown the way, you know, and taking that quiet time, and I think, you know, 6 and 7 are vital. You call them the forgotten steps, and I mean, and, those are, I ask God every day to remove those things and my shortcomings. That's nothing I can do. This is all God. And I got to remember that once I take my will back from my ego, that's bad. That's bad news. And I got to ask God every day to help me with those things and trust that. And, you know, put my hand in God's hand every day and ask for help, because I'm no good on my own. But being able to tap into that power on a daily basis didn't happen quickly, but it was, you know, progressive, like our disease, and a threefold disease, mind, body, spirit, you know, like the obsession, the phenomenon of craving, and the allergy. You know, it's a pretty awesome thing if you let it, you know, let it into your life. And Peter M. talks about being broken so bad that, you know, the spirit, you know, you're cracked, and the spirit, you know, is allowed in, spirit of God. And I was that broken that I was willing to do whatever it took, you know, to try to like work these steps to the best of my ability, and just to put it to the test to see if it really, you know, what everyone's saying is true. And you know, I found it to be so. Looking at my list and making my, you know, my 8-step list, and this is when the magic really started happening for me. Not to set up any type of expectations for any of my amends, to go in there and lay it in their lap and say, how did I do you wrong? They heard me say I'm sorry a million times. They heard that one. And saying something different for once, like, let them talk for once, not just, let me just tell them exactly what I need to hear, they need to hear, so I can get them off my back. And, things felt different that, you know, time, and some don't go the way that you expect, and that's okay. You know, this is God's plan, not mine. And, being willing to let them, like, talk and saying whatever I gotta do to make it right, it's okay. And, you know, I'm making some financial amends now. It stings a little bit, but it's what needs to be done. I cannot say no to these things. I got to do, they tell you to make, you know, all amends, not the ones I pick and choose, not the easy ones. This is how it's got to be. And it's truly like people, I've called people who were so surprised to even hear from me. They thought I was either dead or just in jail or whatever, or doing my own thing like I usually do. And, you know, the reaction I got, like, just to make brighten somebody day for once, instead of like, yeah, I need help again, I need money, like, no, I'm actually doing something different in my life, and I call because I did you wrong at a certain time, and I just wanted to put that out there if I can do anything to make it right, and lay it in their lap and let them talk. And they're like, oh man, that's just water under the bridge, and I always loved you. And that's how some of them go, and that's all right. And some, you don't get that response, and that's okay. And God constantly puts more people in my life that I've forgotten about, maybe by choice or not, I don't know. But my list constantly grows. My amends list constantly grows. I remember I treated this person poorly senior week of high school. And she was so surprised that I called her and she's like, oh my goodness, that's so, like she was a little shocked, but I was like, well, they told me to make them all and I just, I'm not holding back on any regards of this thing. So, I truly believe, that's when the magic starts happening. I mean, the steps are all amazing, but when you can really start to see that freedom start to occur from cleaning up that wreckage, moving forward and, 10, 11, 12, I mean, constantly look at myself and see how I treat others on a daily basis. I'm not the greatest at doing my inventory every night, but I am at doing yours. And that's stuff I need to work on. My prayer and meditation, like I talked about that already, like step 11, I truly believe like that's crucial. My buddy George said when he went through the steps the first time, he would do step 1, step 11, step 2, step 11. His sponsor had a license plate and said it's 11 step or something. And, it's crucial to try to start tapping into this power that's available to us on a daily basis. And I didn't see how it could work in my life until I actually just became open-minded and be willing to try for once. The biggest gift I believe is step 12 is service, helping others, try to put someone else's hand in God's hand. It breaks my heart when I see guys disappear and struggle. But I've been right there. And I just tell my one sponsor would tell me out in Colorado, just come back to us. And he wouldn't reprimand me. He wouldn't give me, tell me what I should do or this. He'd just say, just come back to us. Simple as that. Just come back to the room. Like nothing but love. Nothing but love. And that's what I'm supposed to give is unconditional love for anybody that asks me for help to be there, to pick the phone up when they call and be there if they need help. And most importantly, I try to have fun. If I'm not going to have fun with this thing, I'm not going to stay. I got to laugh. Laughter is so important. We joke around. We kid. Facebook can be used in many different ways, but I believe like the for the comedy purposes, it's a lot of fun, and it can be toxic too. So do be mindful of that, and putting yourself around people who are, kind of have the same purpose and, same direction. I try to surround myself with people who are happy, joyous, and free and be available to anyone and anyone, alcoholic or not. I can't believe that my family now asks me for advice. That's scary. But, that's a struggle on a daily basis. To watch them suffer with anxiety and fear and regret and remorse and resentment and try to bring what I've learned here and I don't cram it down their throat, but I can subtly like show them, like tell them different ways to cope with stuff and just be there for them with unconditional love because like I put them through living hell. I stole a lot of time from them and money and jewelry and you name it. But they always forgave me. They always welcomed me back. They always gave me unconditional love because I'm their son. And there was a time when they said, look, you're cut off. We don't want you here. And I truly believe that saved my life, a little bit of tough love. It made me stand up for myself and say, I got to do this or I'm going to die or go live on the streets and keep suffering. Choice is yours. So now I can be there for them. I can be there for my sister and my niece and nephew. My grandparents too, like just to be there. Cousin of mine's, he's getting out of rehab like Tuesday, tomorrow, and to be there for him. I don't know him that well, but his dad is calling me from Portland, and I'm trying to be helpful with that, get him into a recovery house right away. And step 12 is the true meaning of this thing, I believe, is just helping others. When you talk to somebody else and then get out of your head, you hear someone else's problems and sometimes yours don't seem quite as bad. And if you can just, it helps you to get out of yourself because, I'm blocked by self. I'm self-absorbed and self-centered and I'm bonded by, this bondage of self is what I'm trying to break free of. And helping others is truly the biggest gift. You know, I heard somebody say, if, you know, I have to be willing to give my life to AA, and in return, I'll get my life back. I have to stay in this mindset. I have to stay in this, have this attitude at all times. Once I become, complacent or, unwilling, or it's not fun anymore, I'm not going to be here. I'm gone. And I may not have even picked up. And, you know, this, they say the relapse happens way before, and it could turn into like not going to a certain meeting anymore because there's certain somebody's there, or not going to a meeting because I can't stand what they share at that one. Or these little things are subtle, but they start popping up. I got to watch out for this stuff, you know. And they gave me these tools to look out for these type things. And whether I choose to do it is trusting in God and most importantly, on a daily basis. You know, they tell you in the beginning, you know, get into service right away. Doesn't matter how much time you got. You can always make coffee. They always need coffee makers. Stay and put chairs away. Show up early. And, you know, there's three parts to the meeting. You show up early, you stay for the whole meeting. And then you, at the end, you know, you talk to somebody. And it took some time for me to realize that, you know, in the beginning I would show up a little bit late because I didn't want to talk to anybody. You know, I'd hide in the back, you know, and then I'd blaze right out, barely, I'd sometimes not pray, and wonder why nothing was changing. And I'd tell my dad, AA don't work. Like, that's all I thought it was. And there's so much more to that. Meetings are important. It's great to fellowship, but there's a lot more to it. And this is all from learning, you know, experience that, this thing is crucial in my life in order for me to stay alive. I have to be diligent. I have to be, you know, I just have to be all the way in, or, I'm already out the door just from my experience. We do have a lot of fun. You know, they say we're not a glum lot for a reason. And this comes down to, again, it's a choice, a personal choice. Do I want to make fun with, am I going to make this be a fun time, or is this going to be like a drag, a burden, a punishment? You know, am I condemned to AA the rest of my life, or am I blessed with the program that is giving me freedom and having that mindset for once in my life that this is a gift. My sobriety is a gift, and I have to think of that on a daily basis, that this is something I can't take for granted, because I remember how long I struggled. You know, I gotta remember that every day, that my sobriety is definitely a gift. And I can easily, like I said, I'm incredible at building up and tearing it down, and that can happen quickly if I don't watch out for these certain things that happen on a daily basis. You know, my grandfather once asked me, like, what is God to you? What's God mean to you? And I said, I didn't have an answer. And he said, God is love. And I truly believe that, if you have love, I mean, if you have love for others, that's a doorway to finding God in your life. In the beginning, it may not be God. Maybe just have, you know, a love for people. You know, my relationship with God seems to grow on a daily basis. I don't know how or why, but I know I like it. I know it's helping me a lot. And if I can, you know, I try to, show my mom and dad and, you know, and jab them a little bit with, some God punches here and there. My dad said, I told my dad, well, it's the first time I'm speaking for an hour. And he said, oh my God, how are you going to do that? And I said, God's going to show me the way. And believe me, today I was like, I'm going to start with this and it's going to be funny and I'm going to say this and that and I'm going to knock them out, you know. That all went away as soon as I came up here and just started talking about the program. And thanks, Jay. I don't know, but this was an awesome time. I hope I helped somebody tonight. And thanks so much for the opportunity. Appreciate it.